This meeting is now being recorded.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to the new GTLD Subsequent Procedures Subteam Track 3, String Contention Objections and Disputes held on the 7th of February, 2017. In the interest of time, there will be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. If you are only on the audio bridge, could you please let yourselves be known now? Hearing no names, I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for recording purpose, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll turn it back over to our co-chair, Karen Day. Please begin.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, and thank you for joining us. We will start, per usual, with going over our agenda for the day, which staff has kindly put up in the notes section for you. We will ask for any updates on SOIs. Then we will receive an update on the full PDP group from one of our co-chairs. Next, we will jump into a review of the PC2 questions for Work Track 3, which we are hoping to get out to the full group shortly. Then Paul McGrady is going to walk us through a straw man proposal he had circulated to the list some weeks ago with regards to legal rights objections. He kindly took the lead on drafting up some changes to the AGB for that. And so that's where we'll probably spend the bulk of our time today in hopes that we can get through that subject matter today. Then we will introduce for you, staff will introduce for you a future topic of applicant freedom of expression to get thinking about that. And then if anybody has any other business, I think that should take us through our hour. So if anyone has anything to add to the agenda, any changes to the agenda, let yourself be known. Raise your hand. Not seeing or hearing anything, we will move on to item number two, statements of interest. Does anyone have any changes to their statement of interest that they need to make us aware of at this time? Not seeing or hearing any. Just a general reminder, please do, if you have any change in your circumstance, keep your statement of interest up to date on the ICANN site. Next, item number three, an update on the status from the full working group, where we are and where we're going. Jeff or Avery, either of you, jump in on that. Go ahead, Jeff.
Sure. Unless Avery wants to jump in, or she can add after I jump in. So we do not have a call this week. Did not have a call, full group call this week. We resume our calls, Nick, as you know, they're once every 2 weeks. Right now, we are getting volunteers to form the small drafting committees for some of the overarching questions, and we are keeping an eye, obviously, on each of the work tracks to develop the work stream to, sorry, the work PC2 questions that will be sent out. Sorry, lots of abbreviations here in different groups. Obviously, we're working towards looking towards Copenhagen for a full group meeting on the first day of, which I believe is Saturday. So other than that, that's the brief update.
Thanks, Jeff. Do we have a time for our meeting on Saturday yet?
I don't believe so, unless staff has been given that. I think there are three groups that are asking for times on that Saturday show, but Steve's got his hand raised, so maybe Steve's got more date information.
Please, Steve, go ahead.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks, Karen. This is Steve from staff. And our understanding, I don't know that's entirely locked down, but we will have the first of the three slots on day one or Saturday, as Jeff pointed out. And I believe that runs from 8:30 in the morning to 12:15 local time, if I'm not mistaken. So I think we have a fairly substantial chunk of time for this, the full working group and its work tracks to meet. Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Steve, for that. Hopefully there'll be lots of coffee. All right. Moving on then. CC2 questions from Work Track 3. Staff and I both have circulated a link to the Google Doc where we have the entire CC2 document up for your review and participation in the questions. I, again, circulated yesterday just a PDF of where we are with our Work Track 3 questions so far. I've only had one person on the list, or actually in the Google Doc, go in, and other than staff and myself, make any changes or suggestions. So today I would like to sort of get the temperature of the group. Have you read the document? Are you okay with the questions? Anybody have any concerns about the questions? We have a fair number of questions in each of the sections, as you can see here, objections, which we've been through and are going through in our work. New GTLD applicant freedom of expression, we don't have any questions yet, and I realize we haven't gotten into this subject yet, but hopefully today after the intro we will have some things come to mind that you can contribute for questions in that area. And we can do that on the list. Community applications, community priority evaluations. Again, we have several questions here for the community and string similarity evaluations, as well as accountability mechanisms. Excuse me. does anyone have any concerns, comments, objections to any of these questions? That they would like to speak at this time? Is everyone comfortable with these questions? Are we at a position where we're ready to say that these are our questions that we want to submit to the full work group for their consideration? If you're on Adobe and you want to use your little check mark voting button, that would be great. Seeing Gigi has read them and is good with them. Rubens as well. So we have two positives and a bunch of abstaining this time, I guess. Paul is put up an X. Can you share, Paul? Is there a particular question or area of concern that you have, or you just need more time to go through and take a look at them?
So Paul McGrady for the record. I really would like to understand the freedom of expression issue a little bit more, and I think that we're going to be having a conversation today and perhaps into the next phone call on that before we – I just don't know that I can say for a fact that we've captured all the necessary questions in that space, because I really, to some extent, I'm not sure what people are, getting at with some of these questions. They all look very interesting and they all look very important, but I just don't know that we can – call our question list fully baked without at least talking through the higher concepts on those. Thanks.
All right, thanks. And again, we will begin that on the freedom of expression today. And we will look probably in our, I believe, in our full group call next week. We will also have some discussions on some these concepts as we move forward. With that taken note, then we will. If you have any, again, you've got the link to the Google Doc. Send out questions over the email. Feel free to go into the Google Doc and make any revisions, additions, and we will discuss this more during the week, and then again on our full call next week. And with that, we will move on to our next item, which is the highlight of our call today. Is the straw man proposal we have before us for legal rights objections. We had discussed this several phone calls back and had some good feedback verbally, and Paul had, McGrady had agreed to take a stab at a straw man drafting, which he did. And so I will like to turn it over to Paul now to walk us through the changes that he's made and give us some insight and background, and then we can discuss with him how we feel about this document. Paul?
Thank you. Paul McGrady, for the record. Karen, thank you for giving me a chance to walk through this. I know I tried to do it quickly on another phone call, but we were pressed up against the end of the call. Can I ask just a question about how we want to do this? Do we want to look at each one and ask questions about each change, or should I walk through it and then ask for questions and, you know, go back and address specific items then? What would you prefer?
My thought was that we would it would be helpful if you could walk us through the whole thing to begin with, giving us any commentary along the way about why you made the change you made, and then we would, as people formulate questions, could come back and go through it in more depth. But give us an overview first.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you for that. I'll do that, and that's actually somewhat easier because then I don't have to watch the queue as I'm talking. Starting at the top, you see a minor change from a rights holder to any rights holder. That was simply meant to be a grammar correction. If a rights holder has standing and that rights holder is not identified in the document, I don't know which one they're talking about. I don't think that they meant that a singular rights holder has standing. I think they meant any rights holder has standing. And so that was the purpose of that change. The second change is where I have struck infringed and put in abused. This is really at the core of the flaw in the legal rights objection from the last round. Infringement theory in most countries requires some form of use, and it's not at all clear to me how one uses an application on goods or services, and therefore infringe in this context. Really is a very limiting word, almost to the point of non-existence. And when we talked about this, I was happy to hear, but not surprised to hear, and if he is on the call, I will, maybe that person could identify themselves, but someone on staff indicated that, that they never really thought that anybody would use this except for, you know, just a very narrow subset of claims, if at all. I think it might have been Kurt. I hate to speak for Kurt and claim that it was him, so take it with a grain of salt. But certainly, including the word infringed made this unworkable, and the outcomes that we saw were pretty strange, and a lot of brand owners, I believe, may have chosen not to use this because of the element being so so narrow and somewhat misplaced. Abused is a broader word which opens up essentially other harms besides trademark infringement, which, like I said, it probably doesn't exist at that at the stage of simply applying for a TLD. So that was the purpose of that change. I'll pick up the pace a bit. I added in under interpreting the meaning section 3.5.2, I added in an extra element here, the optional element, this was always filed for the purpose of triggering a private auction proceeding designed to obtain a payment from the objector. This is distinguishable from having been filed for the purpose of engaging in a private auction for top-level domain names that are not, that don't correspond to brands. I know that I think, again, it's been a couple of weeks, I think that John Nevitt raised a concern about this particular one at one point. This is not to interfere with the model of applying for GTLD applications for unbranded terms that can be swapped later. I think that that's an interesting model that emerged that I don't know that anybody was anticipating. It certainly was a brilliant move, but we're not talking about that. What we're talking about is somebody who applies for a brand and then phones up the trademark owner and says, let's have a private auction. that's what we're trying to get at there. If there's a way for us to make that more clear, I think that'd be very helpful. In paragraph number one, whether the apply for GTLD is identical, similar, and if it, or a translation or transliteration of a mark. The doctrine of foreign equivalence is well established in trademarks, and there are translations and transliterations that are used by brand owners across the globe to reach local audiences. And so we wanted to make it clear that in our confusion analysis that we were doing at least as much as trademark offices around the world at looking at whether a domain name is confusingly similar to the objector's existing mark. So that was the purpose there, essentially to bring it into alignment. In paragraph three, whether and to what extent there is recognition in the relevant sector for of the public of a sign corresponding to the GTLD and the market objector, including but not limited to niche market fame. I wanted to make sure that we did not adopt a mere North American approach to dilution. Here, where we have essentially protection only for Coca-Cola and Chevrolet and other mega marks like that, but that we do recognize that there will be brand owners from all over the globe who may be quite famous in, Australia or Argentina or South America somewhere or, who knows where, Iceland. that when we look at whether or not there was recognition that we are not strictly biased against global marks that emanate from North America. So that was meant there to be balancing. Paragraph four, applicant's intent. Of course, this is when we get into these intent issues, this is sort of a perennial problem we have in ICANN land where we try to deduce people's intent from their actions because, of course, nobody files affidavits, telling people what their intent really was not at the time. So applicant's intent in applying, whether the applicant in advance of the time of the application conducted a trademark search. So this is different from had knowledge of the mark. We think that it seems to me if you are going to apply to run a registry, a minimum due diligence process that would be undertaken, just like for any other goods or services, would be a trademark search to see if anybody else has trademarks that correspond to the string you want to apply for. I don't know why we would think that running a registry is any different from any other goods and services that would, be outside of the scope of normal business due diligence. So whether or not they did that, that would be an important factor for the expert to consider. And then B, if the objection is based on common law rights, whether or not the applicant knew or should have known about the objector's mark, due diligence on the part of the applicant before they file, B, due diligence on the part of a complainant before they file an objection, because if the complainant's use rights are very localized, say they are, you know, in one part of the world and they're unregistered, so they would not come up in a global trademark search. Even if they have a significant business, it is entirely possible that somebody else on a different continent would have no reason to know about them. And I think that that's an important item and should be included to balance off of A. No changes to C. D, whether or not the applicant has engaged in past private auctions designed to raise funds from competing applications. You know, this is perhaps, you know, as I consider it, not as narrowly drafted as it could be based upon some of the concerns on the private auction front. Perhaps it is whether or not the applicant has engaged in past private auctions designed to raise funds from competing applicants who have corresponding brand rights, right? So maybe we could tweak that a little bit to make that less of a concern for those who are going to be applying for registries in an attempt to swap them out for funds or for other registries or whatever. So we could narrow that one a bit, but that was the idea there. Essentially looking at, now that we are going into the next round, we have enough history, we can look and see what people are up to. And whether or not the applicant or entity officer board member of the applicant has been named in more than 5 UDRP complaints in the last 3, it says tiers. That must be Freud. Last 3 years as a respondent was the respondent was losing party. So again, trying to bring forward some, essentially this exists other places in the guidebook, but in terms of applicant qualification, but it was left to ICANN to be in charge of that. And, you know, there have been some criticisms, primarily for me, that ICANN did not do a good job in that space. So instead we could have the expert look at it here, and that could be an element. Moving on to paragraph 5, in the event that its string does not correspond to a famous trademark owned by the objector, whether or not the applicant has used or made demonstrable preparations to use the sign with the corresponding GTLD for bona fide unrelated goods or services. In other words, what we want to do here is to take out the ability to get cute and have an applicant say, well, you know, I published a brochure saying that I was going to, you know, apply for the .coke, and so therefore I've used .coke. We want to make sure that in this case, you know, famous well-known trademarks are protected from that sort of gamesmanship. And to the extent that, you know, there might be some other use for a mark that is not famous, some other method if that use is unrelated to the goods and services of the underlying trademark, then I think that that would be an important factor on behalf of the applicant. Trying to come up with an example of that. It's hard to think. I hate to use an example because that would be implying that somebody's mark wasn't famous, and I probably wouldn't be making any friends doing that. But we could certainly think of trademarks that, you know, perhaps are not considered to be globally famous marks. And there certainly are goods and services which are, you know, different from what those marks are used on. And if the applicant can say, listen, you know, I've taken steps to make sure that my registry services won't interfere with the goods and services for this other mark, which is, sure, registered, but perhaps not famous, you know, I think that should cut in the applicant's favor. Moving on to 6. I know I'm moving fast, but I want to make sure we save lots of time for questions in discussion. 6 is whether the applicant has marks or other intellectual property rights in the sign corresponding to the GTLD, and if so, whether the acquisition of such rights and the use of the sign has been bona fide, and whether the purported or likely use of the GTLD by applicant, I would say, strictly corresponds to the applicant's marks or other intellectual property rights. Failure of the applicant to include registration and use restriction prohibiting registration and use of the string in conjunction with the goods and services covered by the objector's trademark shall be conclusive evidence that the applicant does not have defenses under this paragraph. In other words, you know, we've struggled for years about, well, what do we do with people who run out to, you know, this or that trademark, this or that trademark office that, you know, just hands out trademark registrations liberally without examining them on absolute or relative grounds. And how do we avoid that kind of gamesmanship? The goal here is that, you know, if an applicant has a mark and it's bona fide that, you know, if they apply for a registry, they really still need to show that the uses won't interfere with another party's use of their mark. So, for example, you know, the old Delta and Delta, those are two well-known brands that coexist. You know, I think simply dropping a footnote in, you know, Delta Faucet's application saying, and by the way, we won't use this registry to, you know, provide travel services, you know, makes a lot of sense. And again, would be a factor in applicants' favor if they could show that. It would not be a favor in applicants' favor if it looks like it's, you know, gaming the trademarks office in order to avoid legal rights objection. Seven, I just deleted it sort of entirely. You know, the issue here is trademarks, not company names. And so, you know, simply filing for a corporate name, corporate formation document in any one of the 50 states or other, you know, 250 or so countries would, you know, essentially seven could be used to game and defeat the legal rights objection. It's sort of the paragraph seven is an oddity that we've carried forward from the UDRP, which sort of doesn't fit in this space. We're talking about legal rights objections, not talking about whether or not somebody is clever enough to file a corporate name application somewhere. Paragraph eight, whether the applicant's intended use of the GTLD would create a likelihood of confusion with the objector's mark as the source, sponsorship, affiliation, or endorsement of the GTLD. Failure of the applicant to include registration and use restrictions prohibiting registration and use of the string in conjunction with the goods and services covered by the objector's trademark should be conclusive evidence of the applicant intended use of the GTLD will create a likely of confusion, et cetera. You know, the bottom line here is that if the applicant wants to show that, you know, okay, the registrant, the complainant party here has a trademark right, but that trademark right is not – it's based on a trademark that might have some other uses, and then I think that the applicant needs to show that the proposed use of the registry won't interfere with the trademark holder's rights. So everybody likes to talk about .apple in the first round as the example of this. Well, what about Apple Farmers? What about Apple Pie Companies? That kind of thing. And so, again, that's a situation where, you know, if an applicant says, yeah, we're going to use our TLD for Apple Farmers, we are the cooperative for, you know, 3,000 Apple Farmers all over the world, and, you know, we really have a legitimate reason to have this thing. And, by the way, we won't use it to sell electronics. You know, then they should pass muster easily on paragraph 8, and that's a great way to show how a non-trademark use of a mark that otherwise, you know, that is a registered mark and a famous mark, but otherwise is also a, a dictionary term for a kind of fruit, would, you know, those two things would be able to coexist, as opposed to just filing for Apple and saying, you know, gee whiz, Apple is a dictionary word, so I can use it to sell, you know, I can have this registry that's open and wild and people can use it to sell electronics, and it won't be my problem. I think paragraph 8 sort of brings those two positions closer together and will put some burdens on applicants to make sure that they are creating healthy ecosystems. What else do we have here? I'm scrolling down. Okay. So that was it. I know it's a lot. I know I talked quickly. I'm happy to answer any questions, or I'm happy to be told to be quiet. Respond if people want me to, or I can just have the conversation go on and people can asked me to, you know, be quiet for a little bit and have them talk. Thanks, Karen.
Thank you, Paul. While people are, those that want to ask questions are raising their hands to do so, we have a couple of questions in the chat, and I know Jeff had to leave, but he will be listening to the call later on. But Jeff had a question for you. What other harms, other than trademark infringement or likely infringement, would you recommend that this objection address?
So infringement is usually, yeah, I'm here. This is Paul, sorry.
Okay.
So infringement is using a trademark for goods or services in a way that leads to consumer confusion, the two sources are in some way related to each other. And so that's a form of abuse, but it's not, in this case, the primary form of abuse. I would think that the primary form of abuse of having a registry that had an unlimited right to registrations in the second level for any kind of goods or services, including the corresponding goods and services of the complaining party, their primary concern there at the registry level, the applicant level, would be that issue of dilution rather than infringement. It's essentially would weaken the overall strength of the mark, as opposed to being concerned about it having been applied to goods or services. There are other kinds of abuses that would be rampant in the second level that could be addressed by this as well, specifically the things I think I talked about in paragraph 8. Infringement is, in this context, sort of doesn't fit with what we, what an application pre-delegation really is all about.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Christina had asked a question further down the list. I'll come back to the other ones along the same topic. Christina, did Paul answer your question now, or is their follow-up that you wanted to ask about the infringe versus abuse?
He didn't actually answer the question. So
okay.
I guess what would be helpful to understand is that, Paul, are you proposing that the policy recommendation itself requires amendment to go from strings must not infringe the legal rights of others to strings must not abuse the legal rights of others? And if not, can you help me understand what seems to be a disconnect there? I'm just trying to kind of understand the broader framework that this is being discussed in. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Christina. This is Paul McGrady. I think I'm pulling up the final report now. I've not looked at it in a bit. I think that if we have to go back and ask for a policy change, then, you know, that might be, ICANN.org is not, it's not responding. I hadn't considered the issue of whether or not this would require a policy change or if there may be something else in the report that was accepted at Paris that might, help us, shoehorn this in. But that certainly would be a part of what we would need to look at. I'm changing browsers to see now if I can. So that would be, that was principle G. The string evaluation process must not infringe the applicant's freedom of expression rights to protected. That's freedom of expression. And then the recommendation 3, strings must not infringe the existing legal rights of others that are recognized or enforceable under generally acceptable and, internationally recognized principles of law. Examples. Our rights defined in the Paris Convention. So, one of the rights defined in the Paris Convention, is the protection of the notorious marks. And so that would, address the, issue of dilution. Universal Declaration of Human Rights, other things. So we'd have to take a look at, recommendation three to see if what we have now is suitable for what we need for this to do, or whether or not we have to change things. Also, recommendation three, I'm not sure, it says must not infringe the existing legal rights of others. I don't necessarily know that that means trademark infringe the existing legal rights of others. I think that the word infringe there may mean something different than I think it means in this legal rights objection, which specifically limits this to registered or unregistered trademark infringement, right? So I don't think that necessarily the infringement in recommendation three means the same thing as it does in 3.2.2.2.
Thank you, Paul. Christina, do you have a follow-up?
No, thank you. Not at this time.
Okay, thank you. John Nevitt is in the queue, and I know, John, you have to leave in a few minutes, so go ahead.
Thanks, Karen. Paul, thanks. I guess the overlying question I have is, what are you trying to do with this proposal? You know, what was wrong with the LROs in the first round that you would try to do differently in this round? I'm sensitive to it because we applied for only dictionary terms. We applied for 307 TLDs, as you probably know, and we got 11 LRO objections, won every one of them. We got objections on terms like mail, food, music, academy, express, limited, coach is probably the most well-known mark who objected to us. But if you look through your list of intent and change this proposal, I'm not sure how some of those would have come out, and I'm not sure why they should have come out any differently than they did come out. And if you're trying to get at some of that conduct, then we should talk about it and figure out exactly what you want to see that is different than what happened in the 2012 round. Because if, you know, trying to prove intent, our intent was to provide a TLD for people who are advisors. We applied for tips, experts, gurus, coach. We were not trying to, you know, jack up the coach leather company. And how would you know that from the start? You know, if you look at the language you put in there, I'd be nervous about applying for that TLD again, and I shouldn't be. I think it's perfectly appropriate. You know, we had some safeguards in there and everything, but I think it's perfectly appropriate for a company to operate a TLD on generic dictionary term. We didn't do a trademark search on 307 terms because why should we? I mean, there's probably a trademark on every one of them in some jurisdiction, and we were using it, you know, not in conflict with the trademark holder in those jurisdictions. So I guess the bottom is, you know, what are you trying to get at? Maybe there's a much, much, much more narrowly tailored way to deal with it than what you have here. Thank you.
Thanks, John.
This is Paul, and I can respond to that, if Karen, if you want me to, or did you want to move down the queue?
Yeah, go ahead, please, and then we'll get to Alan.
Sure. So, John, I've tried to put forward the changes I'd like to see made and walk through the explanations for them. So I'm not sure if if your comment is essentially that you don't think we should make these changes and sort of a general wholesale notion that you don't want to. Or if there are specific proposals within this that you have concerns about, I'm of a different view in terms of whether or not you should conduct a trademark search before applying to run a registry to understand what's going on out there in the broader scope of the marketplace, just like anybody would do for any new good or service. So I don't know really how to address that. I think the concern here, of course, is that, if you apply for a registry, and you are, not, by applying for the registry, putting the mark on purposes, then the infringement standard sort of doesn't really help you. It's just a misnomer in this space, and that's why the proposed change to other abuse, and also the proposed ways for applicants to show their good faith in applying for marks that have both a very strong brand brand name connotation, like, you know, Coach is a great example, but also have the, you know, corresponding dictionary meaning for people who, you know, give other people advice about what they should be doing in sports or otherwise. And so, you know, I think it would be great for applicants to say, yeah, I see that there is a, you know, we've done a trademark search, you know, in their application state, we've done a trademark search on the term coach. And that's not our intent. Our intent is to use it this way. We're not going to be selling purses, and we're going to be, you know, we will be, you know, not creating a space on purpose where there is a, you know, sell of, you know, where the mark on handbags would be abused. That way, the folks who own that mark for handbags can take some comfort knowing that they don't need to worry about that application, that it won't be used to open up marketplaces for the sale of handbags. You know, that's, you know, those are all fine. Those are elements that I've tried to bake in here. So, I mean, right now I'm looking at purses.coach. It's a pay-per-click ad page for handbags and other stuff. So, clearly, you know, there, in the particular example that you gave, there is potential for abuse. And so what we're trying to do here is to balance that out a little bit more to make sure that as people apply for GTLDs that they are taking in the branding considerations. Thanks.
Yeah, I don't think you answered my question at all, Paul, so maybe we take it offline. What name one TLD that you would decide differently in this round than the last round?
I guess that's an interesting question and designed to not deal with the elements proposed here. John, what you're asking me to do is to go through those lists of cases and, in my own opinion, determine which ones I think, you know, should have been stopped. And that is in the last round. The question here is not only were the elements right so that some of these registries that are problematic could have been stopped, assuming that any of them are problematic, but the question here is also what were these elements? Are they useful to brand owners to use at all, right? And, again, the language here and the balancing of things, I think that there were people were hesitant to use this thing, and consistently, because of the way it was written, the outcomes were you know, somewhat one-sided. I'm not saying that the experts got it wrong in applying what was in the applicant guidebook. I'm saying that what's in the applicant guidebook isn't tied to reality. How can you infringe a good or service by simply filing an application? It doesn't even make sense. It's a misnomer at the start.
Thank you, John and Paul. Please feel free to continue that discussion on the mail list. I can see, where that is something that we do need to flesh out further. Let's go to Alan, who's had his hand up patiently for a few moments. Go ahead, Alan.
Thank you very much. It's on a different subject. Just before this call, there was a briefing on the IGO curative rights PDP that's going on and has just issued their draft report. And it dawns on me we really need a placeholder somewhere here where we mention IGO rights to make sure that what we end up with is in line with whatever the final outcomes of the PDP are. It looks like they're going for a minimalist approach, and it shouldn't be hard to do, but we do need to make sure it's updated at the appropriate time. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. We will take note of that and absolutely include that, since this is the avenue for that. Excuse me. Does anyone else have any questions for Paul while we've got him on the phone today? We will carry this over. I think one thing that we need to discuss more would be good on the list is this idea of predetermining intent, and can that be done? And are the mechanisms that Paul is proposing reasonable ways to sort of get at that intent? So I'd like to have some more conversation around that on the list. Does anyone else have anything for Paul? All right. Seeing no hands, no further questions in the chat, we will put a placeholder on this particular subject now for today, continue it on the email list, and move over, and we have a staff has prepared a brief introduction for us for applicant freedom of expression. And so I'm going to turn this over to Steve and or Emily to walk us through this, give us the background so that we can begin thinking about this. And again, as we go through this, think about CC2. I know we aren't going to get into the full discussion before time to send out the CC2 questions, but think about while they're giving us the background, is there anything we need to add to our CC2? Thanks. Go ahead, Steve. Emily?
Thanks, Karen. This is Emily Barabas from staff. So for those of you who have tuned in for all of the work tracks, you'll notice that staff is now starting to do topic introductions for the new topics being introduced as the sub-teams start to address them. And the purpose there is just to do a little bit of a level setting and make sure that everyone is on the same page as we go into deliberations. And the main purpose of this is really just to go through some of the key topics in the issue report in a consistent manner. So this is primarily drawn from the issue report, and I'll also share a couple of links for those who want to read more. So first, I'm just going to drop into the chat the link to the wiki, which has a few different links, including an excerpt from the issue report that might be useful. So this topic is new GTLD applicant freedom of expression. And starting with a little bit of background on the topic, the two sort of starting points that we're coming from are Principle G and Recommendation 3. So the 2007 final report attempted to balance the rights of applicants as noted in Principle G and others related to the program as noted in Recommendation 3. And Principle G states, the string evaluation process must not infringe the applicant's freedom of expression rights that are protected under internationally recognized principles of law. And Recommendation 3 states, strings must not infringe the existing legal rights of others that are recognized or enforceable under generally accepted and internationally recognized principles of law. Examples of these legal rights that are internationally recognized include, but are not limited to, rights defined in the Paris Convention for the Protection of Industry Property, in particular trademark rights, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, in particular freedom of expression rights. So when I touch on the sort of issue description as framed in the issue report, it's important to recognize that the discussion group wrote this report a couple of years ago. This is sort of a framing, but of course, conversations have continued within ICANN, and more work has been done outside of this working group, and we'll touch on that at the end of this brief introduction. But this is sort of a snapshot of where the discussion group was in their thinking when the report was written. So the issue as identified by the discussion group is whether ICANN gives adequate consideration to the protection of human rights, particularly with respect to new GTLDs and right to freedom of expression, freedom of association, freedom of religion, and the principle of non-discrimination. So the basis of this section of the issue report was focused on a Council of Europe report that was presented at ICANN 50, which was in June 2014, And that the report focus is called ICANN's Procedures and Policies in the Light of Human Rights, Fundamental Freedoms, and Democratic Values. And what the report is doing is trying to look at ICANN's global public interest responsibilities from the perspective of international human rights, including the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and the European Convention on Human Rights. And it's a pretty broad paper, but Section 2.4 specifically focuses on human rights analysis sort of in the context of the new GTLD application procedures. And so that's where this dovetails with the work track three scope of work. And specifically, some of the questions and concerns related to this topic focus on a number of the procedures that we've been discussing in the context of reviews, GAC early warning, and so forth. So I'm just going to, rather than try to summarize the entire report, I'll just touch on a few of the topics that are mentioned in the report and kind of give a couple of highlights. So relevant to the GAC early warning in particular, the report states that there have been several cases and disputes involving potentially sensitive expressions in applied for GTLDs, which exemplify the delicate balance needed to protect the fundamental rights of applicants and other internet users. And here a number of cases are cited where GAC early warning advice was given. It's important to note that not all of these cases are cases where the COE report says that something went wrong. They're just cases where these sensitivities were raised. And some of the cases are cases that involve dissent. So, for example, .fail, .gripe, .sucks. Others involve those that are related to the regulated market sectors, such as .accountant, .lawyer, .doctor. Some involve national and religious concerns, for example, .islam. And then beyond the sort of GAC early warning, they also touched on places where these sensitivities were raised with other review processes, such as .xxx, in which community objections were filed. And another procedure that's mentioned is the string confusion objection and legal rights objection. And the report states that a delicate balance is at stake where freedom of expression needs to be weighed against the property rights of trademark owners. With respect to the community priority evaluation, there's a pretty extensive case study on the .gay case. And the report states that a narrow interpretation of community could restrict the ability of community organizations to associate, i.e. to group them together to achieve goals. It could therefore impact on the right of freedom of assembly and association and the positive obligation resting upon states to protect vulnerable groups. And finally, the report touches on auction procedures and says specifically on page 35, pluralism and diversity can be threatened by auctions as a way to allocate a scarce resource because this could lead to the concentration of GLDs in the hands of a small group of wealthy portfolio applicants. So these are just a few of the issues that are touched on in the report that sort of dovetail with the work track scope of work. And in the rationale for policy development, at the time of the drafting, the issue report noted that other groups within ICANN were beginning to examine ICANN's policies and procedures from a human rights perspective. Since then, quite a lot of work has been done, and so an important part of the work for this group might be coordinating with some of these groups and understanding where they are with their processes. That includes the cross-community working party on ICANN's corporate and social responsibility to respect human rights. Workstream 2 has a subgroup on human rights that's doing quite a lot of work, as well as the GAC Human Rights and International Law Working Group. So those are some of the potential next steps is additional coordination with those groups. And then finally, sort of from a staff perspective, just thinking about how to plunge into this, it's a pretty broad topic area, and there's quite a lot to potentially consider. So one way to sort of angle into this is to look at cases where things went wrong, sort of following the Newman rule and saying where are things broken and where is the potential to fix processes where things did go wrong and not just where issues are sort of interesting for consideration. So that's just one possible way to do it. And the report might give a couple of starting points on that. So I hope that gives a little bit of background, and please feel free to ask questions or send us emails if you have any other questions about the issue. Thanks.
Thank you, Emily. Appreciate that. We will, the slides will be up on the wiki to go back and review shortly, if they're probably already there. Does anyone have any questions for Emily in the last few moments that we have about this topic as we go off? All right, seeing no hands and no comments. We will meet again. Our work track, our next call is February the 21st at 2000 UTC, and we will be taking a break from legal rights objections at that point and moving into confusing similarity objections. I want to keep the legal rights objections conversations going on the list, and then we'll come back to it either on the 21st after some time with confusing similarity or on a subsequent call. But we are keyed up to do confusing similarity objections on the 21st. So I hope you all can join us there. That is all I have for today. Does anyone else have any other business before we sign off and I give you back 30 seconds of your hour? Seeing none, I will say good evening, good morning, goodbye, and everyone have a great day. Thank you for joining.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Thank you very much for joining. Please remember to disconnect all remaining lines and have a wonderful